This week, though, for our main discussion, we're going to explore something that may be considered contentious, uncomfortable, and by all accounts, profoundly misunderstood by too many people in our society, and that is mental health. As we are entering what some people are calling a dark winter with a rising rate of COVID-19 transmission and second wave lockdown measures threatening social isolation once again, people are rightfully worried. What will be the consequences to people's mental well-being? And how does the COVID-19 impact fit in ongoing discussions about mental health and suffering? We have two guests today here to bring up potential answers to those questions and others, including how have people's mental states been impacted by the pandemic? Where has the system harmed people or failed to meet their needs? And perhaps most importantly, what is to be done going forward? Joining the Breezy crew this morning, we have the Executive Director of the Canadian Mental Health Association of Waterloo-Wellington, Helen Fishburne, as well as Susan Rosenthal, a Guelph-based author and retired physician whose body of work includes 2019's Rebel Minds, Class War, Mass Suffering, and the Urgent Need for Socialism, and 2006's Power and Powerless. Thank you both for joining us today. We're going to start with Helen. So Helen, whenever you're ready, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you so much. About 10 minutes, Dustin, just to kind of share a broad perspective.
Yeah, anywhere between 5 and 10.
Okay, great. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for the invitation to join your wonderful group. I've been here before at invitation from James Gordon, so thank you so much. Any opportunity that we get to talk about mental health, particularly through a global pandemic, is always a good opportunity for us. So I thought I would just maybe give you some really kind of big picture comments about the impact on our mental health through the pandemic. And then, of course, I'm really interested to hear Susan's comments as well, and then we'll answer any questions you might have. So, big picture comments. I've thought of the pandemic, and this is not scientific. This is just my perspective, having traveled through it with our team here at CMHA. There's been some phases through the pandemic. When we first started in the spring, we went through a phase I call spring lockdown. And that was obviously very new. We didn't know what was up with COVID-19. We didn't have a lot of information. There was a lot of fear and uncertainty, and we all needed to really scramble to get our lives in a whole different way of operating. And what I call kind of stunned compliance during that time. We really didn't understand what was happening, but we all really quickly followed public health guidelines, and we were in a really serious lockdown at that time. Through the summer months, we moved into some progress. We understood more, there was more information, we knew what we needed to do to protect ourselves. Public health was extremely clear around masks, washing your hands, and keeping 6 feet apart. We all understood what was required, and we started to see the curve being flattened. And I describe that as kind of more coping and resilience during the summer months. And of course, they were warm months. We were able to be outside and socializing more, even with the public health restrictions. As we moved into the fall, things became much more difficult. Families had to make some difficult decisions about whether to return their children to the classroom or whether to choose online learning. Many businesses were trying to really get their businesses back on track. There was a lot of fear and anxiety at that time in terms of wanting to maintain the flattening of the curve. But as we were returning more to the community and schools and businesses were back on track, it became harder to do that. Excuse me. So at that point, it really became exhausting for people. The restrictions had been in place since March and April. People were just getting tired. It was exhausting. Following all the restrictions, keeping away from people that we love, just not getting and giving hugs as a simple thing was really hard on people. And we started to see that exhaustion. And not surprisingly, the COVID numbers went back up. So I kind of described that season as a bit of a fall apart. given our mental and physical exhaustion during that time. I think the next phase of things is very much hope for 2021. We know that there's a vaccine on the horizon. We know that good things are coming next year. They will bring more stability to our world. It won't be overnight. It's going to take months for the vaccine to roll out. And we certainly hope that people will embrace the vaccine as well. But there is hope on the horizon. I've been thinking of the pandemic very much like a marathon without a finish line. We have been running and running and running. It's been exhausting. It's been overwhelming. There's been a lot of people that have struggled, but we do have a glimpse of a finish line. And that's important for us to know because we need to hold on to that hope and hold on to each other as we get over the finish line. Just in terms of the mental health impact, we've certainly seen an increase in our calls and our HEAR 24/7 door, which is the front door to mental health and addictions. We typically get about 4,500 calls per month into HEAR 24/7, which is a lot. Through the pandemic, we've seen those calls go up to 6,500 a month. It has been a significant change in the baseline of mental health and addiction issues across our communities. We used to talk about 1 in 5 Canadians being impacted by a mental health and addiction issue. We now know that it's through the pandemic, this has been 5 out of 5. And that doesn't mean that everybody has a diagnosable mental health condition. What it does mean is that each and every one of us has been impacted by this pandemic. Our lives have been disrupted. We have had more levels of stress, worry, fear, anxiety. We have been really impacted by the social isolation. There's been financial hardships. The list goes on. Every single one of us has struggled through this at one time or another. I will also tell you, we have seen tremendous acts of resilience, courage, strength, innovation, community collaboration, networks of care and support, kindness. So we've also seen some incredible gifts and strength throughout our community as well, which we have really needed. We're not going to be able to get through this crisis unless we have the informal support system, which is actually gathered around this table, along with our formal healthcare system and our formal systems, which include police, paramedics, first responders, public health, and all of us who work in healthcare. This crisis needs both of those systems, both informal and formal, to keep their eyes out, to look after each other, and to come together to bridge those needs. I know here at CMHA, we can't be everywhere. And we don't want to be everywhere either, because we want people to be able to take care of themselves and to take care of each other, and then to really bridge those folks who are struggling with the formal system. We know that some people can reach out to us, and certainly 6,500 people a month are reaching out to us. But we also know that there's people that we need to reach in, and that's where we rely on amazing people in our community like yourselves to be able to do that. So I hope that just gives you a general sense of where we're at. It's a journey, and it's been a really hard journey, but we're certainly hopeful for the next phase of things. But we've got some time to go between now and when the vaccines roll out. And I will tell you that the next few months will be really hard on people, given the level of exhaustion and fear that people are holding.
Great. Thank you, Helen, for that overview. I'm hoping to see lots of questions pour into about what the CMHA has been doing throughout the pandemic. But before we get there, I'm going to hand over the platform now to Susan Rosenthal. And Susan, you also have 5 or 10 minutes to give us a broad overview of your perspective.
Thank you, Dustin. Thank you for inviting me to the meeting. It's good to see so many people out. I agree. A vaccine is a very welcome development. However, I don't think it's going to be the solution for a number of reasons. A lot of people won't get it. We don't know how effective it is. It may lead to a false sense of security if it isn't. We know that viruses mutate. That's why we have to get a flu virus vaccine every season. And also, new pandemics are emerging. They will be emerging for the same reasons as this one and the previous ones. Now, I don't want to be conveying a very pessimistic message. However, I think we need to be realistic if we're going to face the crisis that we're in. I don't see any finish line on the horizon. I think, you know, this is the new abnormal. And it's going to go on for quite a long time for a number of reasons. We have an economic crisis, a recession, which was starting before the pandemic and is now going to reach levels unheard of in our lifetime, certainly in mine. This is going to be a major disruption to most people's lives. We're already seeing this with people being unable to make their rent, losing their jobs, not able to manage working from home and also schooling their children. These are unprecedented and overwhelming burdens that are being placed on people. And I think that added to that, I think it's a mistake to attribute the spread of the infection or the rise of new cases to socializing with friends and family or private social gatherings. Well, these things certainly, you know, can spread infection from one individual to another. They're not the primary cause. The primary cause are the deep systemic problems, such as long-term care facilities with low-waged workers who have to work in various facilities in order to make ends meet, the failure to actually protect people in those facilities, farms that employ migrant workers who do not employ the proper distancing and sanitary and medical care that they need, prisons, you know, none of which are being protected in the way they should be. And in our communities, we have many low-wage workers who lack sick pay, have to go to work sick or starve. We have poor people crowded into housing where they cannot isolate. We have homeless people unable to protect themselves. And we have too many employers who are not protecting their workers on the job with distancing, sanitizing routines, and personal protective equipment. Now, add to this, we have no coherent public health system. We have a patchwork of agencies and institutions at various levels of government, and they have failed to coordinate their pandemic response from local to regional levels to province. And this has created confusion and distrust among ordinary people that the people who are in charge actually know what they're doing and are able to solve the problem. I mean, let's face it, this is pretty basic biology. We know how to stop infections. You test, you track, you treat on a massive scale. Instead of doing this, we're blaming individuals for coughing on one another instead of people who have the power to implement effective public health measures on a population-wide level. Why are we not testing, tracking, and treating on a massive scale where there is a reluctance to invest in that kind of massive public health intervention? The other problem is that efforts to protect businesses at the same time as stop the virus have clearly failed. The countries that locked down everything did much better and their economies are recovering. Whereas countries that, like ours, that employed half measures in order to try to maintain their economies are on a downward spiral. Certainly we're not in as bad shape as the US, but I think the same pattern will be coming here. Now, I don't think we need doctors or therapists to adapt us to the new normal. We need a solid plan for eliminating this virus and protecting us from the next one. We need rent relief. We need income support. We need housing support. We need job security. We definitely and desperately need quality, affordable childcare. And without these things, people are hugely distressed, and they have every right to be distressed. This is a monumental economic and social crisis. People are going to feel anxious. They're going to be scared. They have every right to be, to feel depressed, to seek refuge in addictions. I think it's a mistake to tell these people that there's something wrong with them. They're not adapting or managing or resilient enough. This is not an individual or medical problem. This is a social crisis reverberating in people's minds and bodies. And there are no individual medical solutions. We really need to find ways together to focus on what needs to be done and to push the people in power to do that, instead of blaming each other, ourselves, the individuals around us who really are drowning as much as we are.
Fantastic. Thank you, Susan. So at that point, with our guests' positions sort of established, I'm going to move into the questions that have been submitted by people in the audience here. So first up was from Joe Carpenter. So Joe, if you're ready to pose your question, then you can go ahead and unmute yourself and go ahead.
Yes, I'm unmuted. Yes. Helen, I'm just wondering about, I'm just wondering about Christmas. It's always a stressful time. And for us people who aren't, we're under a little bit of stress due to COVID, for the people who are calling 6,500 people, is that a month, I think, or a day? Mm-hmm. What is being done? What programs are in place to help them? Because Christmas is going to be one of those very stressful days that, how are we helping them to cope?
Great question, Joe. Thank you. So we're doing a lot of work now to prepare people for Christmas. You're right, it's not going to be our usual Christmas. We know that. So it's important that we acknowledge that and not just pretend that this is a regular happy holiday season. I mean, one of the things that makes Christmas happy for people is to spend time with their loved ones, to bring everyone around a table, to have a meal, just to celebrate. And those are the very things that we're not able to do in a pandemic. So we need to acknowledge that and actually adjust our expectations and our mindset going into Christmas, which then adjusts our behavior. We need to know that this is not going to be a regular Christmas, and we need to know what we can and can't do together. There are still ways to enjoy your holiday season with a little bit of planning and some positive thinking, and that can still bring peace and joy to people. But it won't be our usual Christmas. So what we're having, what we're really encouraging people to do is to plan ahead for their holiday season and to start thinking about ways that can create meaning for them, which you can safely do. There are ways, for example, to connect virtually with your extended family. There are ways to still see people, visit people, connect with people that don't break the public health guidelines. And those are the things that we want people to do. I know in my family, we're already talking, there's 25 of us that are just my immediate and extended family. So what are the things that we can do to connect with each other, to support local businesses? Even though we're all not going to be around one Christmas table, there are ways that we can still enjoy each other's company and share a perspective of gratitude and love for one another. On the work side, CMHA is doing a lot to support our community. We're going to be increasing our Here 24/7 staffing over the holiday season. We also see a lot of calls through our police system. And for those of you that don't know, we have an amazing program called IMPACT, which is Integrated Mobile Police and Crisis Team. And those are mental health clinicians that are paired with our police, our detachment. So, for example, we have 5 staff that are embedded with Guelph Police Service, 4 staff with Wellington OPP, and we have 11 staff that are embedded with Waterloo Region Police. So when a 911 call comes in relating to mental health and addictions, our mental health clinician goes with police to respond, to de-escalate that situation, to assess for crisis, and then to make sure that person and or family has supports and is bridged to the support system following that crisis. We also do that on the Here 24/7 side. That is our mobile crisis service that is not police generated. It's just community generated. We do tend to see people who are in crisis more during the holiday season. It is not a happy time for people that are struggling with mental health and addiction issues. So we're expecting some increased volumes and needs over the holidays. We also have set up a new website through the pandemic for people who want to access resources, want to connect to virtual care. There's all kinds of links for virtual care. And we have all kinds of webinars that are hoping to increase people's skill set and resilience. Certainly what we know is resilience is not enough. Our resilience probably wore out sometime this summer. we're into actually needing to get people treatment, support, and care. So those are the things that we're really focusing on in terms of our community support.
Okay, thank you, Helen. I'm going to invite Susan to answer that question as well and comment on anything that she heard.
Thank you, Dustin. There is a huge need for support at the community level. Absolutely. I mean, we are social beings. We need to be connected with one another. And had the proper procedures been put in place when this pandemic was first emerged in December, we would not be in this position. And I think that's, you know, we can't forget that. The suffering that we're seeing that's being prolonged is because of systemic failures at the highest level. And so we're picking up the pieces. You know, we're doing damage control for a situation that is damaging, where people are losing faith in officials who are giving them contradictory messages, not putting effective plans in action. And unfortunately, I mean, having worked as a psychotherapist for 40 years, there's very little you can do for people when their primary problem stems from material reality. They're going to be kicked out of their apartment. They're going to lose their home. They've lost their job. They can't put food on the table. They don't have, their kids are going nuts because they're isolated. Therapy can't solve these problems. We don't have enough therapists. There are too many of these problems. These are systemic problems that indicate a severe social crisis. And it's really just beginning. You think people are wanting to feel hopeful. I want to feel hopeful. But realistically, we're at the beginning of a precipice and a downward slide on a global level. Even if we were to eliminate COVID in Canada, you can't completely close your borders. As long as it exists anywhere, it's going to come back. We have no global plan for protecting everyone, for protecting ourselves, from preventing the next one. You know, I mean, I was given a box of masks and sanitizer after SARS that sat in my closet for a long time. I then gave it to the local hospice because I figured they need it more than I did. And then COVID hit. So there's going to be more of these for the same reasons, right? So while we have to help people in whatever way we can, at the same time, we have to recognize that is not the solution. It's not nearly enough. And we need to move quickly to a solution, because we're seeing a breakdown in people's belief that anyone is really taking care of us. Because in my opinion, they really aren't. I mean, they're trying, they're good intentioned. I have no question, no doubt about that whatsoever. But they're not making the hard decisions that will really stop this pandemic, like a complete lockdown for 1 month of everything. And then testing, tracking, and treating, like immediately and with enough numbers and with fast enough turnaround results. We were totally unprepared when that pandemic hit. We've been playing catch up ever since, and we haven't caught up by a long shot.
Thank you, Susan. Joe, I hope that addresses your concerns adequately. And I'm going to now pass the baton over to Juanita. And Juanita has a couple of questions, so Juanita, go ahead with the first one.
Yeah, I think one of the things that should be really clear to everybody is we need to deal with the housing crisis. And one of the ways that that has manifested in Guelph is finding places to put homeless people to isolate, in combination with the fact that some of the homeless people are using and should not use alone without any supports put into place. And I know of one particularly, because it hit close to home. It was one of my former neighbors who ended up dying out there due to an overdose. And it's a huge concern. Sorry. the fact that evictions are going on now is insane, but we need to really deal with all kinds of housing issues that have been left until we're in the middle of a pandemic. And it's, you know, if anything, it should make it clear that it has to be dealt with, but I don't know that some people are getting the message. So I'm really thinking about numbers. We hear about the actual official deaths due to COVID, how many related deaths are due to COVID and all the issues that surround that. So that's one of my issues. The HERE 24/7 line, I ended up calling it recently due to not an urgent thing, but someone was sitting in our lobby who didn't live here, didn't live in the area, wasn't really clear about what was going on. And I ended up calling the number and was on hold for about 10 minutes. And the woman ended up just saying, okay, I'm just going to go. I'm fine. She had been looking for a ride out somewhere, but I don't know if that's something that can be used for, I don't know if 24/7 deals with that kind of thing. I didn't have a car, so I couldn't take her anywhere. I didn't know who to call. A lot of people where I live don't have cars. I guess it's an opportunity to build community, but in the meantime, is 24/7 something that can be used for that kind of an issue?
Okay, thanks. I will invite comments first from Susan and then Helen on this one.
Well, we need to solve the homeless problem. We need to solve the problem of lack of sick pay, of lack of childcare. The burden on women is just overwhelming. I mean, it was hard before taking care of your kids and going to work. And now either you're not working because you've been laid off and you don't know how you're going to feed your kids, tremendously stressful, or you have to work from home and you're also trying to take care of your kids who are going rangy because they can't see their friends and, you know, can't do the normal play activities. There are so many social supports that are missing, they've been cut and cut and cut, or were never there in the first place. And then, of course, as Juanita says, pandemic hits, and then you pay the price of this. You pay the price of having reduced your hospital and bed capacity to the absolute minimum. You know, you pay the price for this, and then all of it, and then you're surprised. You're surprised that people are falling through the cracks. Seriously, we need a complete overhaul of the way we organize our society. We really have to start with what is going to provide people with a healthful environment and build your society around that, not what is going to support the economy. And if people have to die, well, okay, so be it. The economy comes first.
Just want to thank you, Anita, for just sharing some of your story and expressing concern for your friends and loved ones. It's really hard to see people we care about struggle, and even see perfect strangers struggle. And that certainly has been our experience all through the pandemic. So thank you for voicing that. Absolutely agree. We are in a housing crisis in Guelph in particular. We have one of the lowest vacancy rates in Ontario. Our housing prices here are very high. So we're in a particular struggle here locally. I will tell you, there has been a tremendous amount of momentum and local work being done on public housing. The mayor has created a task force. We've been meeting at the table for the past year. And from that, practical, real options are emerging. If you've followed the news in the media, it's received some excellent coverage. Right now, we have three or four options that are on the brink of becoming a reality. It's not going to get every single person housed the way it needs to, but it's going to be a great step forward. And I will tell you, between the health system, the social system, the municipal government here we have in Guelph, and our friends on the corporate side of things, there's some really good momentum and activity happening to make public housing a reality here. So I feel very, very optimistic about what's coming. We also have some emergency housing that's been put in place through the pandemic. The drop-in center in particular has done an absolutely fantastic job of creating emergency housing. At Here 24/7, we also provide emergency housing for people and literally people that call us in the middle of the night and they are on the streets. And the record numbers of calls that we have had has been absolutely astronomical. We have never seen anything like this, and I've worked at CMHA for 20 years. So we're doing the absolute best we can to provide emergency housing through the drop-in center. And I think you all know that right now that is out at Ignatius College at Loyola House. And also just through some shelters and hotels as well, which we are sadly having to provide for young families who have nothing right now. It's not perfect, but we're doing absolutely everything we can. I totally agree with you about evictions. That should be a legislated requirement. And I don't understand why it's not, but that's something that through COVID is absolutely unbelievable that those evictions are still happening right now. Just in terms of Here 24/7 tends to be a catch-all for a lot of folks that they're not quite sure what to do or where to call. I always say, if you're not sure, just call us, because if we're not the right service, we will certainly connect you to the right service. In a lot of these situations, there isn't the right service to call. There isn't one place which deals with everything that we're seeing. So what we try to do at Here 24/7 is really address the immediate concern and issue, respond to that if possible, and then also link people to the other resources that are available. Again, it's not perfect. We're doing our very best. And we, you know, are able to support literally thousands of people a month. So that's something that we also need to hold on to, because there are many other communities that don't have a Here 24/7. So we're very fortunate that we're doing the very best we can here.
Thank you, Helen. And for my part, I just want to echo the issue of evictions is a very urgent one right now. The Landlord and Tenant Board of Ontario held around 2,300 eviction hearings during the month of November. And in many of them, tenants were evicted in as little as 60 seconds by the adjudicators, one of whom is on the record saying that they are treating the Landlord and Tenant Board like an eviction factory. So that is what low-income tenants are facing right now after having lost their income throughout the pandemic. But I don't want to spend too much time on that, because we have a contribution right now from Aisha Jahangir. Aisha, if you want to reintroduce yourself, just in case some people here don't know who you are or what you do, and then tell us what you've been going through from your perspective, then please go ahead.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having this forum. It's really important to talk about COVID-19 and the impact on our mental health. I am a registered nurse, and my specialty is mental health. And currently, I'm working at the Hamilton Wentworth Detention Center. It's located in Hamilton. It's also known as the Barton Jail. When COVID first hit back in March, I was in the position of acting healthcare manager. And things were changing really, really quickly. We were getting updates from the ministry and public health numerous times. That meant that nurses had to change what we were doing, what we were looking for as symptoms, how do we isolate, how do we care for, how do we test. So lots of changes. During that time, we were also trying to make sure that staff felt that they were supported, that they knew that we had their best interest in at heart, that they had the appropriate PPE. There was great concern about the lack of PPE and how do we conserve it. I'm glad to say that at this point right now, we have done very, very well to keep both the inmates and the staff safe. Our great concern is public safety and to protect the public. So we have processes in place. If someone is suspected of having COVID because they have symptoms, but yet have not tested positive, how do you self-monitor? How do you self-isolate if you are positive and you're being discharged? Our communication with public health to make sure that they are aware that someone is leaving the institution that requires to have a follow-up on a consistent basis. What's been challenging is the First Nation and Indigenous reserves, because public health don't have jurisdictions there, but we want to make sure that that community remains safe. So at time of discharge, we're connecting with leaders over there. Communication has been absolutely critical in this process. I find myself, I have gone back to working on the front lines as mental health, and I'm very glad to be there to support the inmates. Now with this second wave, I am supporting inmates that have lost loved ones or have family in ICU or hospitalization beds, and just letting them know that there is support here, that I'm here to hear for them, listen to them. Unfortunately, I may not be able to do what they would like for me to help them with, but nonetheless, I hear the concerns. There's a heightened worry, and it's worrisome when we hear about what potentially could happen at our own institution. Things, the outbreak in Calgary, the recent outbreak in Saskatchewan. But I can tell you that we are doing whatever we can. Also making sure that the staff feel that they are supported. If they ever have symptoms, please don't report to work, right? And letting them know that, you know, they like help them understand that it's not just about the work stressor, but the stress that they go to at home, right? They are also concerned about the holidays and making sure that their family is safe, because God forbid if they were to get sick, the potential risk that they would have to their family and loved ones. So along with that, I had the honor of working with Trent nursing students from Trent University, and we worked together on producing a pamphlet around community supports and services and how they may have changed due to COVID here in the Hamilton area, so that our inmates have that information readily available in their hands, because there have been some changes in the drop-in center or the food bank, respite or shelter homes. So I'm glad we were able to do that. I just want you to know that all of us are working together, and we will get through this. I'm trying to remain hopeful, because as far as I'm concerned, that's all we've got. Thank you, everyone.
Okay, thank you, Aisha. I'm going to invite comments on Aisha's contribution here from Helen first and then Susan. And if you can keep in mind kind of a question that goes well with that, you know, kind of the question of what are the stresses like among mental health workers and people on the front line of this type of health services, as well as support workers and things like children's aid and things like that. So Helen, if you have any thoughts, go ahead.
Sure. I mean, the first thing I would say is thank you, Aisha. They are very lucky to have you at the Barton Jail. And that kind of support, care, treatment, particularly for people in jail who, you know, have very little control over anything, is so important. So thank you so much. We have done the exact same thing you have at our shop in terms of following the rules, making sure everybody is safe and protected while we step into the space of caring for our community. It is not an easy balance as a healthcare workforce, but it is so essential. If we're not doing that, our system becomes destabilized. For example, if we're not caring for really ill people with mental health and addiction issues in the community, then those folks destabilize. They end up having to go to hospital and then be admitted. And that's the last thing we want to do, is drive people into hospitals right now. We want to keep people well. We want to keep them supported and do everything we can. So I'm very proud to say at CMHA, we have not had one single positive case of COVID amongst staff or amongst the clients that we support. And that's because we have done everything we can. And we have had a steady supply of PPE from the province as well, which has been very appreciated. So those are great examples of if you do the right thing through this pandemic, then you can make a positive impact. Not everybody has access to PPE, and that's part of the challenge for sure. We were so concerned about the toll this was taking on our healthcare workforce and our first responders that we actually created a program in May called Here for Healthcare. And that streamlined and fast-tracked mental health care for our healthcare workforce. So we are currently supporting doctors, nurses, first responders, and anybody in our local healthcare system that needs an urgent and immediate response because of the overwhelming pressure and exhaustion that they're facing from COVID-19. So that those folks can, first of all, stay well, but also keep working in our system so that other people can stay well. So we've had a really good response from our healthcare workforce for this program, and we're just going to continue to offer it. It won't end when the pandemic ends because there's going to be layers and layers and PTSD that we'll have to deal with for a long time to come in our healthcare workforce. But it is, again, a gap that has emerged, and it's something that we've been able to step into and really provide that support, and we just need to keep doing it.
It's been a huge challenge for frontline providers, especially in the healthcare system, and they have done, as they always do, the very best, stepping up, going above and beyond, working long hours, and many of them have gotten sick and some have died. And I don't think that we can expect anything more from these people. And that's what really makes me angry, is that they are not being supported in the way that they should be. There's no reason why somebody under these conditions should have to work a 12-hour shift on top of it. We need shorter shifts. We need more people in the healthcare system. People are burning out. They're getting sick. They're becoming traumatized by being unable to help people. It's like a story of Dr. Lorna Breen in New York, who killed herself after feeling completely hopeless because she couldn't do anything. People were coming in and they were dying on her watch. And I think that we don't support our healthcare workers enough. We don't staff properly. They don't all have PPE. They don't get the breaks they need. They don't get the childcare support they need. I know doctors in this province don't get sick pay. Right? They don't get any compensation for closing their clinics or offices if there's an outbreak. You know, there are just so many systemic problems that make it difficult to bring the virus under control. I know in some places, more so in the States, nurses have gone out on strike. I mean, they have to be pretty severe distress to take such a move in a pandemic, but because they're not getting the support from management that they need. So, you know, it's one thing to praise them, to admire them, to call them heroes, but they're not getting the systemic support that they need. They're burning out. And unfortunately, as I said before, this is not going to end anytime soon. There's a it would cost $1.3 billion just to clear the backload of surgeries from this pandemic. I mean, they were already backed up before. And now, how are we going to catch up? Where is that money going to come from? Our health system is being crushed, literally. And it's showing up in the sickness and distress of our frontline workers. And I don't see that there's any relief coming for them because the money isn't being invested, right? So everyone is doing the best they can. The responders are doing the best they can. Ordinary people are doing the best they can. Most of us are wearing masks. Most of us are sanitizing and distancing. And yet the systemic weaknesses and fractures in our system are going to allow this to continue. And then what do we do? I think we have to be prepared for changing some things. We can't just say, well, just hold on till it's over. I think that's a mistake. We can't hold on under these conditions for much longer.
I would just add, respectfully, Susan, we're not just holding on. we're doing lots to support our healthcare workforce. I work closely with the leaders in the hospital, in primary care. I see the incredible efforts that are being made to support our healthcare workforce. It's not just a whisper and a promise, it's actually practical support that we're offering. These are incredibly exceptional times. Of course, the hours that we're asking our healthcare workforce to work, and our first responders, and my own staff, those are that we're trying our best to meet the needs in our community. And everybody has to make a call around what they can and can't work. And if people need to put boundaries in place around that, we encourage it. I know the hospital does as well, and I know primary care does as well. We're all trying to find that balance in terms of how far we can push ourselves to meet the needs in the community while still taking care of ourselves. And for everybody, that's an individual call. But I will reassure you and everybody else on this call, there is a lot of practical help being offered to our healthcare workforce locally, and a lot of care being provided. Don't disagree that we need more help. There are system issues for sure, but it isn't fair to say that we're not offering the help and support. We absolutely are. And I just want to be really clear about that.
I don't doubt that you are offering as much support as you possibly can in all kinds of creative ways. And just as Aisha's doing, I mean, that's tremendous work that you're doing, Aisha. I've no doubt about that. What I'm saying is it's not enough. It's not enough. People can't be working 12-hour shifts on a prolonged basis in these conditions. We need more people in the health service. We need more people to be in social services. We are suffering from having cut them back over the past 40 years. And now we need to have an influx of people. And that's not easy to do because we need to train them. We have the lowest number of beds in Ontario per capita of the entire country. That's not an accident. That was policy. We're paying the price now. And even though we can do everything we can on the individual level, it's just not enough. The systemic problems have to be addressed. We need a public health service that has lots of redundancy built into it so that when we have a crisis, we can manage it. To cut down the public health service and social services to the bone with no redundancy means we have no ability to respond to a crisis other than by forcing people to step up, compromise their health, their lives, their well-being, and their families in order to make up for these systemic deficits. And that's not to malign anyone's good intentions or anyone's effort. These systemic problems existed before the pandemic, and they've made it worse, and we have to correct them.
Well, I'm going to move to a point of, I think, agreement between the two of you, which is, you know, that more funding would be welcome and or necessary. So Diane was asking, as all that was going on, how do you suggest we help regarding the underfunding? And I think we'll go to Susan first and then Helen.
You're saying, how do we address the question of underfunding?
Yes.
Well, that's a question of what are the social priorities? What are the priorities in society? Where do we put our resources? And that's, you know, that's a political discussion about what matters most. And we have not prioritized human welfare. We have not prioritized public health, medical health, emotional health. We haven't made that a priority. We've just assumed that people have to take care of it on their own. And if they stumble, well, you go to the doctor and you get treated. We need to have a complete shift in society. I don't have an easy answer for that. That's a collective responsibility for us to shift society towards towards making social support the primary priority. I mean, how long have we been promised pharmacare? How long have we been promised a national childcare system? If we'd had a national childcare system in place, we could have quickly relieve the burden on people who had to work from home. We could have made those places safe. And we could have kept a much larger population safer. So I don't have magical answers. I think that's something that we collectively have to work on. We're not going to work on it if we think that all we need to do is just get through this crisis and then go back to normal. But normal is what got us to this crisis. This is abnormal. and it will continue to be for quite a long time. So, yeah, I mean, I totally, having worked in primary healthcare for 40 years, I understand the need to be on the front line and take care of people. Absolutely. But I've also learned from that experience that it doesn't solve the problem. There's more sick people today than when I started 40 years ago. And those are systemic issues that we have to address.
Helen, your response?
I would totally agree. We need absolutely more funding for our system. There's no question. Just in mental health, we get 6% of the overall healthcare budget. So we're constantly competing with cancer, diabetes, hips, knees, and sadly, mental health issues cut across all of those issues, as you know. So we struggle with the underfunding absolutely every day. We have a very strong voice provincially. We do a lot of advocating. So CMHA Ontario, for example, there's multiple associations, including the Ontario Medical Association, the Ontario Hospital Association. There is a lot of advocacy that happens provincially, and that will continue. You know, there's not an infinite amount of funding. So we're all, you know, we'll all take what we can get, and it isn't enough. There's no doubt of that. I will say one of the silver linings in the pandemic is we've always been looking for a way to break through stigma relating to mental health, and we've been looking for a way to bring mental health out of the shadows and onto the front burner, if you will, into the light. And through the pandemic, we have certainly seen that happening. People, for example, who have never experienced anxiety, depression, worry and concern to the extent that they are now have a renewed empathy and compassion for people with mental health issues. We have seen that shift and that change in our system, which, you know, everything starts with a person's insight and understanding, and then heads farther up the system. So having people understand and have an increased empathy and compassion for mental health will help us advocate for more, get more, because people now actually understand it. Now, because what they have experienced through the pandemic, it's going to lead to more voices asking for help for our system. It's going to lead for more people becoming active in advocating, because one of the things we've always struggled with is that people don't talk about mental health. It continues to be in the shadows, and that doesn't help our advocacy in terms of getting more support when there is that silence. So I'm optimistic about that change that we see. It's sad that it's happened this way, that we needed a global pandemic for people to get increased compassion and understanding about mental health. But again, as a silver lining, we'll take it and we'll work with it and we'll advocate for more.
Susan, you wanted to add something to your earlier comment.
Yeah. One thing I think that is definitely on the table is that we have lost a lot of our funding. I mean, as Helen says, we're very underfunded in public and social services. And one of the reasons for that is money is going elsewhere. And one of the reasons where places it's going is to the police. And in Guelph, I think we have a scandalous situation of a monumental new police station being built with many tens of millions of dollars while we have people homeless. Right. So these are some of the, even at the local level, that could be addressed in terms of channeling some of those funds or a good portion of those funds into social services that would also reduce the need for police in the first place. But I do want to take up this question of people being more supportive of others with mental health issues. And that is that we know that where people see mental suffering as a response to adverse conditions, they are much more supportive of that because we all have been through those kinds of conditions. Where people see mental health issues as biologically based or medically based, they have much less tolerance. They have much greater stigma because that diseases are yucky and no one wants to get too close to them, kind of unpredictable and so forth. But I think the characterization of what's happening to people's lives right now as a mental health crisis, I don't I think that's a mistaken way to look at it. I know that is the way that we've been looking at it, but I think it attributes what we would expect people to feel in these conditions to some kind of medical problem. These are not medical problems. These are reasonable, expected responses to very difficult and adverse conditions. This is not pathology. The conditions are pathological. People's responses are pretty normal, I would think. And of course, the people who are in most precarious situations are going to have the most difficulty, of course. But we don't do ourselves or society a service by saying this is a medical problem that needs treatment. This is a social problem that needs treatment. You know, and I think that there are two completely different strategies when you look at it in those ways. I mean, Helen's looking at it as a medical problem that needs treatment. I'm looking at it as a social problem that needs treatment. And, you know, I'm not sure you can do both. I think at some point we have to decide, do we fix the conditions so that people don't have to suffer? Or do we put more money into helping them to adapt to the conditions that cause them to suffer?
Ran out of time again. That's all. Thanks as always to our guests and to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Alt, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gavert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. If you'd like to support the work that we do on this program, please visit patreon.com and look for Breezy Bullhorn. Thank you for any support you can lend, and as always, for listening.